Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Oh, it's so good to have you with us again as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, and open innovation. Those of you who are listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. In the first half hour, we're going to explore the questions of thorium, and see if it really should be a substitute for uranium in our nuclear programs. We're going to hear from two people, two experts on this. Paul Frenger is one. He's from Houston. He's a conservationist. And Ed Morse is a nuclear scientist at the University of California at Berkeley. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our Fountain of Useless Information, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments of the Voice of Reason to make real insight on the Iranian nuclear dust-up. But now let's get on with the thorium question.
Stand by.
All right, we're lucky to have on the line today Paul Frenger. He's a medical doctor from Houston, Texas, and served in the United States Air Force, as a matter of fact, back during the 70s. Paul's making a presentation at the IEEE Green Technologies Conference, and he's a fascinating person. Fortunately, he's been around long enough that he's got some real-life lessons he can impart to us. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Now then, you have two presentations you're going to be making at the Green Tech Conference. One is a paper, refrigerant-free air conditioning, which I want to get into in just a little bit, and another is a poster entitled "Edible Organic Semiconductors." You also believe in safe thorium cycle nuclear powered generators, which could be used to make which can't be used in the making of bombs and that sort of thing, and that would be the answer for countries like Iran that want to use nuclear and not have to worry about them making some bomb that's going to destroy Israel. Explain that a little bit for us, will you?
Yes, I'm going to take you back for a second to my paper at NASA a couple of years ago regarding Captain Nemo's submarine, the Nautilus. I said that in that paper that it would have been possible for Jules Verne to think technically of a thorium reactor for his Captain Nemo submarine. All of this material that was there at that in the 1860s was known to exist by that point.
Mm-hmm.
So it was technically possible without knowing much about radiology or radioactivity that such a nuclear device could have been made. Thorium is more plentiful than uranium by a factor of about four.
Really?
It exists in a single isotope in nature. It does not need to be enriched as uranium does. You know, every year that goes by, the amount of uranium-235 in the Earth's crust goes down due to natural radiation.
Okay.
So after a period of time, there will be virtually no U-235 available for nuclear reactors. But thorium always exists in its only isotope, and when you put it into a reactor, all you've got to do to start going is just supply it with neutrons, and then you have your nuclear power. Thorium is not easily converted into a bomb. It's very difficult to do that. And so, for example, if the United States and other countries came to Iran and said, look, you can't have nuclear power, peaceful nuclear power, in the form of uranium reactors because they can be used to make bombs. But we will give you the technology to use thorium instead. Would you do that? And I think it might be possible to avert a war if they were willing to say yes. Now, of course, if they said no, then their true intent would be obvious at that point. But thorium has been successfully created as a nuclear power source by the United States, by Germany, and by India, among others. So I think that would be a good alternative. But good old Captain Nemo in the 1860s could have had a thorium reactor in the Nautilus, and it would have worked just fine.
Well, now, this is, I mean, you know, this sounds, Paul, utopian. I mean, why then are we not using thorium instead of uranium currently? I mean, is it that hard to get or that hard to refine, or what's the drawbacks to this stuff?
No, as a matter of fact, in the first place, thorium, like I said, is about four times more plentiful in the Earth's crust than uranium. It's widely distributed throughout the Earth. I think that India has one of the largest supplies of thorium, and they have an active program in using thorium for a nuclear fuel. It is only mildly radioactive in its natural state, and like I said, it does not have to be enriched, which means you don't have to get a particular isotope in order to make it work. I think that one of the problems with thorium has been politics. For example, uranium and plutonium, which are used in nuclear reactors, have been used for many, many years, and there is a very big, I don't want to use the word cartel, but let's say business organization that promotes the use of these. The other thing is that most countries, for example, the United States, Russia, China, and so forth, who are currently using uranium and plutonium in their nuclear reactors, there are also nuclear countries who make bombs. Okay, and so you would think that a country that wants to become a nuclear power would also like to be able to hold up a nuclear weapon in its hand and say, look at me, look what I can do, and you should pay some close attention to me. And you take that away by going to thorium, and I think a lot of countries would say, well, gee, I'm great, I'm a nuclear power, I can supply electricity to my people, but I don't have a bomb, so I'm not as good as these other folks are. So you see the political aspects of that. Their economic and political byproducts.
Are you trying to say then that we have the alternative of using another substance besides uranium and plutonium in the form of thorium, and we're ignoring that entirely because humanity is basically warlike people? There isn't any other reason?
And listen, you forget I'm a medical doctor and I was in the Air Force, so I know all about human nature. Yes, unfortunately, we are, as our ancestors were, very warlike, and that has to be, you have to control that.
Okay, so what can be done to forward then the use of thorium instead of uranium and plutonium? What about the current reactors that we have right at the moment that are generating electricity through nuclear power? Can they be easily converted to thorium?
You know, I haven't really looked into converting existing plants into the use of thorium. But remember that every one of those plants we currently have that use uranium, those will eventually be decommissioned. They have a limited lifespan. They age naturally, of course. They also are damaged by the radioactivity that's released in the reactors themselves. And then every one of those reactors also builds up tremendous amounts of spent fuel, which has to be stored. I believe that most of the reactors in the United States, that nuclear fuel is stored right there on site.
Mm-hmm.
One of the advantages of a thorium reactor is you can take spent high-level nuclear waste and burn it in the thorium reactor. So the advantage that obviously is with thorium is that with over time, you can get rid of all these high-level radioactivity deposits. Render the environment safer again over a long period of time.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and certainly, you know, solves the problem of nuclear waste that we've talked about in this program many times here. But surely there's got to be some reason other than war material why there isn't some sort of a thorium lobby going out there somewhere saying, hey, this is the way to move. Why isn't President Obama talking about this?
Well, there actually is a thorium interest group or a thorium user group, and they are attempting to promote the use of thorium for reactors worldwide. But remember, they're working against decades and decades of uranium reactor experience and commercialization. It's always difficult when you're the little guy to come into an established market and become the big guy. And between you and me, I believe that thorium would be a better solution for nuclear power. For example, a so-called molten salt reactor that used thorium in that form, these are fairly easy to make. They're not difficult to manage. They cannot go critical like the Fukushima reactors in Japan did. You don't have meltdowns with this kind of technology. And so when you lose control of the nuclear reactions, they just stop. They just simply, the fire goes out. And I think that's a lot better than having explosions and releases of radioactivity into the water and the air that you have with the uranium / plutonium reactors. So the little guy on the block is having a heck of a time trying to get the big guys to listen to him. But let me tell you, here's the futuristic approach. We're going to use up all of our fissionable U-235 sooner or later. It's going to be so hard to find U-235 uranium that we will have to give up on it. At that point in time, those vast deposits of thorium will start looking very attractive, and the economics will shift. It's like, what will happen when we use up all of our petroleum? Well, after a while, you can't use it anymore, and so you look to other sources, for example, natural gas. It may be hundreds of years down the road, maybe only 100 years down the road, when the uranium is not going to be attractive anymore because you just can't get enough of it.
Wow. And is there a drawback to thorium, like how to mine it and that sort of thing? You say it's four times more plentiful than uranium, but is it difficult to come by, and making it economically more expensive to use than uranium? Is that a possible reason?
No, as a matter of fact, that's not. It's not four times more powerful, it's just four times more plentiful, which means there's lots of it. There's only one isotope, so again, it does not have to be enriched in order to be used as a fuel. You may have had contact with thorium and not realize it. For example, one of the uses of thorium is in the mantle that goes into gas-powered night lights. If you've ever been camping, you have one of these little lights that you put the gasoline into it, and you put a match to it and turn it on.
Sure.
Well, those mantles often contain thorium because it gives a very bright white light. It's just a chemical effect of it. It's not a nuclear effect. But anyway, again, this material is very plentiful in the Earth's crust, and it's easy to mine. And the Indians, because they have the largest deposits of thorium, are more or less at the forefront right now of using thorium for electric generation.
All right, now let's get into
Paul
this
about his presentations at the IEEE Green Technology Conference going on in Tulsa, Oklahoma. His paper entitled "Refrigerant Free Air Conditioning" and his poster entitled "Edible Organic Semiconductors." But we're going to save that for the second half hour, because after hearing about his ideas on thorium being a nuclear substance that can be maybe solve the problem in Iran with their weapons controversy that's going on right now, we got on the line an old friend of ours who is a member of what DePaul Frenger would refer to as the established nuclear community. Edward Morse. Dr. Edward Morse is a scientist at the University of California at Berkeley, and we want to bring these questions of thorium to him. Wonderful to speak with you again. I haven't spoken with you now in some time, but I think about you all the time, Dr. Morse.
Okay.
Well, the reason is the last time you and I spoke, nuclear power was making a real strong comeback, and you had mentioned to me about how nice it was that you, when you told people what you did, they were all impressed again, where for years you were kind of there in the wilderness, and then Fukushima happened, and I thought, gee, I wonder how things are going with Dr. Morse. I need to call him one of these days. And then I have a real compelling reason to call you, because there's new interest now in thorium, and I was hoping that you could fill us in on what's going on in that.
Okay, well, thorium has gotten sort of a cult following, and I'm not sure why. They tout certain advantages for it, the main one being that there's lots of thorium out there, and they can use it as nuclear fuel in reactors by a breeding process.
Yeah.
And but the from my perspective, it really is essentially the end product burning in a reactor is very little different from what we do now with our uranium fuel cycle. The main proponent of a thorium-based fuel cycle is India, and the reason is they don't have very much uranium around. And the idea with thorium is it's not a nuclear fuel per se, but it's a fertile material, it's called, which means that if it's exposed to neutrons, which are made by another fission process, then it converts thorium-232 into uranium-233. Okay, and most fissionable isotope of uranium that exists in nature is uranium-235, and that's what we enrich uranium for nuclear fuel to bring up its content in 235. Uranium-233 doesn't exist in nature because of a shorter half-life than the age of the planet, but it is a perfectly fine nuclear fuel, and the thorium, when it's put in a reactor, breeds the uranium-233. And when that's put in a reactor, it as a fissionable material, it then performs almost identically to what uranium-235 does. In other words, it makes lots of energy, but it has this, almost the exact same spectrum of fission products that come out that make radioactive waste.
Well, then, what would be the drawback of it then, Doctor? It sounds like it's a pretty good solution, and I'm told you can't enrich it to make bombs with it.
That's not true. We made a bomb. We blew it off in the desert in the '60s. It made it 20-30 kilotons. It was called Teapot. You can look it up. Makes perfectly fine bomb, and you can look at pictures of the mushroom cloud on the internet.
Okay, so what's the drawback then in using it if it's more plentiful and it does the same thing as uranium?
There's no drawback per se. It's just that it doesn't have any particular advantage over uranium unless you happen to live in an area where there isn't a lot of uranium available. You know, right now nuclear fuel, the availability of enriched uranium for nuclear fuel cycle isn't much of a problem, especially considering that right now what we're doing for fuel, instead of mining it out of the ground, is we're blending down Soviet weapon-grade material and burning it in reactors. There's no real advantage in the U.S. to that. India has a particular instance where they don't have a lot of uranium, and they do have large supplies of thorium. So what they're doing then is they have a couple of reactors that are made, I think, with some parts originally purchased from Russia that get the thing started, and then they breed thorium and make nuclear fuel with it. And they're proposing a large fuel cycle based on this. And in fact, we have our eyes on this now because it perhaps will result in a large quantity of uranium-233 in a fuel cycle, which potentially means that it could be a threat for proliferation into nuclear weapons by third-party terrorists and things like that.
Currently, we're using old Soviet weapons that we're melting down and using that for our nuclear fuel. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, a lot of what we're doing now is downblending highly enriched uranium that makes nuclear explosives and using that in reactors. And in Europe, they have a fuel cycle which is called MOX, and it's based mixed oxide, and that's a combination of uranium and plutonium. And in fact, at Fukushima in Unit 3, they were testing some MOX fuel in reactor number 3. That was not a contribution to the reactor accident there. It was only like 5% of the core. But it was more to prove that they could eventually move to a uranium-plutonium fuel cycle. And guess where the plutonium comes from? Bombs! We all have too many bombs, and we're getting rid of them, and we're converting it into nuclear fuel that goes in our reactor. So right now, there's really not a great shortage of nuclear fuel because of the legacy of U.S. and Soviet nuclear weapon supplies.
Okay, and you're not a fan of thorium at all. Is that right, Dr. Morse?
I think that it's being oversold, and for some reason, it has this cult following, and I think. Some of the proponents of this are making claims that simply aren't true, that it's somehow better and has less radioactivity or has less proliferation threat than the standard uranium fuel cycle. To me, it's it's hard to stay awake when people talk about thorium because it's really no different from the normal fission fuel cycle.
All right, so the only thing it's got going for it is that there's more of it than there is uranium, and right now you don't see that there's any kind of shortage of uranium, and so you're saying what's the big fuss?
Yeah, exactly. Right now we can nuclear fuel to run reactors with is not much of an issue.
Well, yeah, but I mean, how are you faring now that Fukushima has happened? Are you back in the dark ages again now with nuclear?
I suppose we are. Remember that nuclear power is not just a policy issue. It is a commercial issue. Somebody has to pay for it, some utility company. And what we saw is that the utility companies that were starting to thaw out over nuclear issues have sort of drawn back a little. But that's mostly a financial decision as well as a political one. There was a license application for a nuclear plant in the southeast, and it was recently approved by the NRC. So it's you know, not over, but it's going slowly. And let's remember also that we're in a recession, and the amount of electrical demand is always lower when there's a recession on less manufacturing, less general use of electricity. So it's not as urgent. I actually worry about an economic boom here in California. When that happens, we suddenly get blackouts, and then people start debating things that they should have been debating 15 years before. But right now, things are quiet, but not dead, and you'll see nuclear power inch back out of its shell. I did a lot of interviews during the Fukushima crisis, and bottom line, nobody died. Nobody's going to die from that thing, near as I can tell. The Japanese, while not perhaps getting an A-plus in dealing with the catastrophe, at least got an A-minus, and they're doing a hell of a job trying to clean up and protect their people. I think that really exposes the ugliest side of the business when it's done well.
Wow, that's an interesting concept, an interesting way of looking at it. How are things at UC Berkeley? Are you still getting a lot of interest in your nuclear classes there?
Oh yeah, we're experiencing a very heavy interest right now, and as you might expect, Berkeley has this reputation of always being on the fringe, and so our interests have to do with the nuclear non-proliferation technology. They have to do with medical imaging. They have to do with, nuclear fusion, and they have to do with alternative types of advanced reactor fission technology. And so those subjects are, still popular, and we get a very high grade of students that are interested in them, and a lot of fellowships and financial aid are available from the government because they're interested in producing the next generation of nuclear savvy people, because clearly there's a lot of issues in government regarding nuclear technology, from the non-proliferation standpoint, from potential energy technologies that will need some looking after by our government.
All right, Dr. Morris, as always, thank you so much. This is the third or fourth time we visited, and I really enjoy calling on you, and thank you so much for being available.
Okay.
Just a program note here. Be sure and stick around to the end of the program when Dr. Morris comes back in the Voice of Reason portion of our program and gives views on the current situation of the nuclear program going on in Iran. He has extremely interesting views. Okay, after we get back from the break at the half hour, we're going to get Paul Frenger on the line with us again and talk about refrigerant-free air conditioning and edible organic semiconductors. So stick with us. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today? Oh, yes, the real voice of Teddy Roosevelt from 1912.
The principles for which we stand are the principles of fair play and a square deal for every man and every woman in the United States. A square deal politically, a square deal in manners, social and industrial.